We're here to remember and honour the deeds of Dick Wordley. Don't know of Dick Wordley? You should be so lucky. He was the great investigative journalist who tracked down kidnapped children. He was everywhere, relentless, never giving up. I remember one night, actually it was about 2 in the morning, and we were having a post-mortem after putting the paper to bed. The editor-in-chief strolled in just back from lunch. Hello, Des. And suddenly the phone rang at 2 in the morning. Don't answer that, Cahoon, I said. Why not, he asked. Because at this hour of the morning, the only calls I get are reverse charge calls from Patagonia from Dick Wordley. The phone kept on ringing, and finally I gave up and answered it. Signor Riddell, will you accept a reverse charge call for Mr. Dick Wordley? Where from? Bolivia. Dick had tracked down another one. We'll be back to our usual format at 1 o'clock when I'll introduce our very special guest speaker. But for now, here's Dick Wordley's son, Milton, to tell us about the Dick Wordley International Language Award.
Thank you. I really am just going to say thank you on behalf of the family. Franz, who's going to present the award in a minute to the journalism student, really started the Dick Wordley Foundation a number of years ago. Milton Howard, his good friend, has continued to organise things. And every now and again, Megan Lloyd from The Messenger and I and Milton get together and I think we have a couple of meetings a year. I'd like to thank our sponsors, and they are 5DN, Messenger, The Press Club, Channel 9, The Advertiser, Southlight Photo Agency, which I have a bit to do with, and the Vocational Language Learning Centre. And on that, introduce Franz, who's going to present the award. I should tell one little aside. My father spoke very fondly, regularly of Philip, and I knew he'd kind of got a little older when he didn't employ his old-fashioned Ways and Means Committee when he sat at the Siebel townhouse once waiting to meet Philip. He couldn't get past the receptionist. Philip had invited him in, and Philip knew he was coming. He just couldn't get past the receptionist. And he sat there for an hour or so, and he talked about it later, and he wasn't angry or anything. He said, I had nothing better really to do. I just sat there, and I left. But he did speak very fondly of Philip, and on behalf of the organisation, we're very pleased he's able to come today. And if I could hand over to Franz, who's going to present the award. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Milton. Our distinguished guest, Mr. Philip Adams, the Acting Vice-Chancellor, University of South Australia, Professor Michael Rowan, the Adams School of Communications, University of South Australia, Professor Michael Galvin, the members of the Wordley family, Mr. Milton Howard, who is the Chairman of the Dick Wordley Foundation, the Chairman of the SA Press Club, members of the SA Press Club, and ladies and gentlemen. Last year, about this time, we were very privileged to have Mr. Ray Martin to help us launch the Dick Wordley Memorial Language Award, and that was on behalf of the LLC. And in it, we invited journalism students from the University of South Australia to submit written entries of how the ability to speak a second language would help them in their media careers. My colleagues and have interviewed all these entrants, and we've read their submitted entries, always in our mind's eye, thinking, I wonder what old Dick would have said or thought about this. And we would like to congratulate the entrants, all of them, of the very high standard of their submissions. it was really very hard to select a winner. As you know, journalism carried Dick into many countries and cultures and situations. And in reminiscing with us, he was always saying, I wish I'd had the language, the second language, on the day. How much easier it would have been for me to get the story. He was always talking about getting the story. Dick was a very passionate man with a love for helping young journos, and I'll say that with inverted commas. And we're proud to carry on this love that he had, which will enable the winner of this competition to learn the language of his choice by the year 2000. Don't believe me? It's a fact. I'm pleased to announce, on behalf of the Dick Wordley Foundation and the Vocational Language Learning Centre, that the winner of the 100-hour Spanish course, which will enable him to speak Spanish by Christmas, is Matthew Neagle. Before I go any further with Matthew, I wanted to take this opportunity to thank people who've had a lot of input into screening the entries, and in particular, Megan Lloyd of the Messenger Group, Chief of Staff of the Messenger Group, for helping judge the entries as the representative of the SA Press Club. And now, it gives me much pleasure to give you... And I'll ask Matthew to say a few words, if you can think of any.
I'm very excited and feel very humbled to stand up here with everyone from the South Australian media in the room. I'd really like to thank the Vocational Language Learning Centre for this unique opportunity and, of course, the Dick Wordley Foundation. And of course, the South Australian Press Club also for allowing this opportunity for me to learn the language. Spanish is it's a fantastic language, and I'm really looking forward to hopefully travelling overseas at the end of next year. I need to get a bit of a financial backing, as you could understand. And but once I do go over there, I really do hope to expand my journalism skills and to open myself up to the world. I mean. Adelaide's a wonderful place, and I do sort of hold it close to my heart, and I'll always call it home, but there's a lot of other places out there which I'd love to see, and this is going to help me do it, and hopefully to bring it home using my journalism skills and share it with a lot of other people. So thanks once again. Thanks.
As they say in Spain... Hasta mañana.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. While I'm talking and doing the housekeeping, please eat like crazy, as Don Riddell always says, and then we'll get the food through and the clatter of the knives and forks out of the road. I'm Sue Fraser, and on behalf of my colleagues on the South Australian Press Club Committee, the news directors and editors of the various media outlets of Adelaide, I wish to acknowledge Telstra as a corporate supporter of the Press Club and to welcome representatives of Telstra here today. Please applaud them. Additionally, I'd like to thank Qantas for their corporate support and also SA Brewing. If you're not on our mailing list for these functions and would like to be and like to receive notices, please just leave your business card with Merle out at the front desk. I would also like to apologise to a few people today who found difficulty with seating. There was a little hiccup with the seating numbers today, and there is a function next door, and we apologise if you did have problems with finding a seat. We'll make sure it doesn't happen again. If you would like to attend the next luncheon, let me tell you what it is. November 19, it's Tim Flannery, who's the new director of the South Australian Museum. He's done everything imaginable. He's an extremely interesting person. So November 19, put that in your diary date now. Now, to keep our Press Club books balanced, we have a raffle, and raffle tickets are on the table. They're just $2 each, or $3 for $5. And you could win these things. We have, thanks to the Dick Wordley Foundation, a set of beautiful books, the ones in front of you, me here, of contemporary Australian photography, entitled The Fuji ACMP, Australian Photographer's Collection. Philip Adams wrote the foreword to book number 4, and they're valued at $320. We have 6 bottles of wine from the Press Club cellar. We have $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouges Street, thanks to Alan Rogers. And, of course, we know the Rock Lobster specialises in southern rock lobster and other exotic seafood. A $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street, just around the corner, to enjoy some traditional and modern Italian cuisine. And a carton of SA Brewing Hahn Premium Light. So, if you haven't got a raffle ticket, make sure you have. Now, as a courtesy to our guest speaker, would you please ensure that your mobile phone is turned off? And for the formal introduction, please welcome back the president of the South Australian Press Club, Don Riddell. Thank you.
Such a fantastic character as Dick Wordley to honour, we had to have a fantastic speaker. So we have one. Perhaps that should be fantastical. A man who is part icon and part gadfly. Ornament and irritant. I suspect he's a deeply serious man, but he's so damn witty it's hard to tell. In advertising, he made commercials that were almost worth watching. He's been involved with films that are definitely worth watching. He used to run the Australia Council. He's now a very successful cattle farmer. He wants a new flag. He tells dirty stories, and he has a lot of problems with God. I don't know what he's going to talk about, but our speaker, doing honour to Dick Wordley, is an extraordinary Australian, the very speakable Philip Adams.
I actually never met Dick, almost met him. Thanks for that appalling anecdote. I had no idea that I stood him up that day. We talked on the phone from time to time and we exchanged letters. But I wish I had met him. He sounds like the most wonderful fella. And thank you, Wordley family, for inviting me. Look, I wrote a great big speech. There it is. I don't want to deliver it. Do you mind? It's very boring. Can I dispose of it and ad-lib something instead? Would you accept it if I just chatted to you about the big media? Well, you haven't heard yet. I want to talk about the big media story out of Sydney, which also impinges on South Australia. That's the 2UE ruckus. Is that okay? Can I talk about that? Thanks. An affair of the heart took me to Sydney about 12 or 13 years ago. And basically, I'm a hermit. I haven't accepted an invitation to anything apart from this for the last 30 years. I literally haven't been to a party for 40 years. And I live on a cattle property, as far away from people as I can get. But what I enjoy is relating to the wider world through media, you know, because I do a wireless program at night, and it's terrific because I just write out a wish list of people I want to talk to. And the ABC tracks them down, and they'll come and talk to someone they've never heard of, on a radio program they've never heard of, on a network they've never heard of, often in a nation they've hardly heard of. So when I got to Sydney, I was approached by a contemporary of Dick's, Brian White, quite a formidable journalist in his own right, who was putting together a package for Kerry Packer, who just bought 2UE, and he offered me the late night gig. And I thought, well, why not? I'm not doing anything from 11 till midnight, and I thought I could talk to people in that sort of quarantined way, so you don't have to talk to them afterwards. And I had a lovely time. I had a producer. He was really just a knob twirler, but he'd ring people up during the day, and I'd say, go and get me Manning Clark. So he'd get Manning Clark, and I'd talk to Manning for 2 hours. Unheard of on commercial radio, but it sort of worked. But it gave me an insight into this extraordinary joint which slowly but surely filled with these emperors of the air, the likes of Laws, Alan Jones and Stanza Manick. Now, first of all, let me paint you a word picture of these creatures, because they're all very different, one from the other. Alan Jones, you might remember, had a rather embarrassing incident occur to him in a London toilet. And I remember sending him a telegram of support at the time, saying something about British spunk. And when Alan got back from that interlude, that frisson, he came round to see me and told me that it had never happened. And I said, Alan, I'm the one person in Australia who assumed that it had happened, but I don't get the stuff. It's your business. I said, choosing policemen for sexual partners does seem a bit reckless, but, you know, each to his own. I quite liked Jonesy because he had a quality that your chairman has. He has energy, prodigious energy, and I find that attractive. And I noticed that Alan wants to be socially accepted. He's desperate to be accepted by the very people in society who don't like people like Alan. And, for instance, he's a failed Liberal candidate. He got pre-selection for a very obscure seat and didn't win it. And he then worked for Malcolm Fraser. And, of course, Alan is the author of that immortal line of Malcolm's, "Life wasn't meant to be easy." Now, Malcolm paid his dues, because when Alan was temporarily inconvenienced in a convenience, the Prime Minister, who I'm told is on the 37th level of the Masons, he may be a Mormon as well, but he's certainly a Mason, he apparently phoned Chris Patton in Hong Kong. Chris Patton phoned Lord Archer in London. Lord Archer phoned Scotland Yard, and everyone at Scotland Yard are in the Masons, and things were sorted out. Now, the thing about Alan is he's desperate for social acceptance, and so his way of trying to achieve it is to become a rah-rah man for conservative causes and an inspirational speaker. You see these do's they have on around Australia, where you'll get sort of burnt-out cases like General Schwarzkopf and Gorbachev coming around trying to rev up middle management, although what the bloke that destroyed the Soviet Union can possibly offer middle management, I find it hard to imagine. But Alan comes along and does the Australian end of that. He sort of jumps around like a deranged leprechaun, and you leave the encounter feeling invigorated. Now, he does the same thing on air, and of course, the thing about Alan is he's always on the wrong side of every issue. For instance, Alan was the driving force behind that inspirational campaign to get Joe in as Prime Minister. So I always found Alan enormously amusing and essentially harmless. I mean, no one was going to make Joe Prime Minister. Anyone who was silly enough to think it was worth worrying about needs one sympathy and compassion. So here's Jonesy, who is, in fact, an ideologue of the first order, and he's got an agenda as long as your arm. Contrast him with John Laws. John Laws believes in nothing. Nothing. He has no belief system. I used to find it absolutely intriguing. I'd watch John come in the morning sometimes, and he still works, because if the light goes out on the microphone, John dies. It's a peculiar... It's the strangest thing. As soon as the little red light comes on, he sort of... And when the light goes off, he sort of collapses. He's a bit like his own ventriloquial doll, and he packs himself away in a suitcase at the end of every shift. In the morning, John sticks his finger out the window to see which way the political winds are blowing. Well, he used to do that. These days he has people stick their fingers out the window and do it for him. He then goes with it, whatever it is. He'll go that way. He's the consummate populist. But John does believe passionately and profoundly in money. And I believe in money too. I just think you can take it a little bit too far. But John totally believes in the big quid. And so there is nothing he won't do for money, which produces in this person, who is not unintelligent, a deep self-hatred. And the central fact of John Law's is that he loathes himself. He knows that what he does is appalling. And I'll talk about, it's not just the fee speech, it's what he does for nothing that's appalling. But he knows that what he does is entirely meretricious. And I used to say this to him, John, you know that what you're doing is shit, don't you? And he'd shudder a little, but acknowledge that that was probably true. Now, as a result of this, he has migraines almost every day. And he works through migraines. It wasn't that an extraordinary thing? I told him that I used to get migraines every day until I decided to leave my wife. And I'd never had one since. And I said, you should try this, John. You should leave the princess. You'd be much better off. But he clings to the princess. Anyway, he comes on air and he sits at his enormous Boeing console, and he brings with him a little black thing, which is very mysterious, which is a voice equaliser. John's voice is, in fact, very, very tiny and high-pitched, but when he puts the equaliser in, it becomes deep and grand and mellifluous. And off he goes. Now, no matter how crook he is, no matter how seething with self-hatred he is on a given day, no matter how high on the Richter scale the migraine, John gives an extraordinary performance. As John Brennan, who's the program manager at 2UE, used to say of John, every day is opening night. And it's true. After all these years, John still attacks the microphone with the same energy. Mind you, he doesn't need a lot of intellectual energy, because almost everything John says is written for him by others. This includes his newspaper column, which John has never written and I doubt has ever read. And I think this is a splendid way to run a journalistic career, and I only wish I'd thought of it. So here's Jones, who's got this ideological fervour, who would like to hand Australia over to the lunar fringe. And here's Lawsy, who doesn't really care what he says as long as there's a quid in it. Then you move across to Stanza Manick. Now, Stanza Manick is a failed experiment in genetic engineering. And I think the CSIRO are to be reproved for allowing him to escape. I had the late night time slot, and I was preceded in that slot by someone whose name I can't remember, and whose obviously name no one could remember, because the ratings were always very bad in the slot before I came on. Now, this is a great worry to a radio station, because they like to think of it as a huge wheel, and each shift should pick up from the audience level of, oh, hello, my dear, lovely to see you. Every audience should pick up from the last, and so, you know, Alan Jones hands over the breakfast audience, or that momentum to Laws, who then hands it on and on and on. So if you've got a couple of spokes out of the great wheel, it's a problem. So I went to management and said, look, we've got a bit of a problem with the person whose name I can't remember, because no one's listening to him, and it would be rather nice if somebody did. And John Brennan said to me, well, what's the problem, do you think? I said, well, the problem is that 2GB have a Maddie. They've got a guy called Brian Wilshire who believes in UFOs, bodily abductions, that AIDS is another fart experiment at the CSIRO, and every conspiracy theory known to God and man. And who is also, in fact, I'm convinced, terrified of the Jewish conspiracy, although he's far too smart ever to mention the word Jew. And I said, people seem to like this nonsense. They seem to like a madman. And as God is my witness, and of course he isn't, but if he was, he would have witnessed this. John Brennan said to me, then we need our own Maddie. What a responsible attitude to journalism. They needed their own Maddie. Now, they got a hamburger cook from South Australia to be their first Maddie. I can't remember his name either. Perhaps someone can prompt me. Arch Tambakis. Yes, Arch. Arch had the brain of a surprise pea prior to immersion. And that was on a good day. But Arch was insufficiently mad. Insufficiently mad. That was his problem. So from somewhere they dredged up, and I use the word advisedly, Stan's a manic. Now, Stan is the worst of the three. No, he's not. Laws is. No, probably Alan. One of them is the worst of the three. They're all the worst of the three, really. But Zemanic is different in that he is simply vile. Now, I don't want to get the South Australia Press Club any litigation out of this, so I'll allege that he's vile. And I actually threw him out of the studio on two occasions when I heard him saying the most reprehensible things about Aborigines. I just couldn't bear it. But it worked. He got the entire taxi driving audience of Sydney, and then it started to flow out like toxic sludge until his virulent attacks on women, because he's a deeply, deeply misogynist, on trade unionists, Labour voters, school teachers, students, dole bludgers, feminists, Abos, Cambodians, Vietnamese, etc., etc., until these attacks sort of generated a sort of a critical mess. And he became equally successful as his collaborators. Now, at about this time, I'd had enough of 2UE. No, I'll leave that to later. Okay. So we had these three maniacs on 2UE, and 2UE was just charging ahead, leaving the pack behind it. Now, as I said, I used to like talking to Manning Clark for a couple of hours, but 2UE thought this was a bit eccentric. It rated, but it didn't fit the format. So they used to tell me that I'd have to do open line. I'd have to do talk back two nights a week, just so they felt more secure. So I started inheriting the people who'd been trained by John and Alan and Stan to say horrible, repulsive things on radio. Now, I had a bit of a problem with this. I didn't like talking to people who were homophobic and racist and said appalling things about people whose skin wasn't the right colour. So what was I to do? I had three things I could do. I reasoned. I could get them on and then dump them, because you're all powerful if you're a talkback announcer. You've got the little red button. You can talk over them and humiliate them, which is what, of course, Jones and Laws and Zemanic do to the odd person who disagrees with them that they allow on air, and only for that purpose, any reason you allow people to come on air and say things with which you disagree so that they can be humiliated. So I had the choice of doing that. I had the choice of pretending I didn't have callers, and I did that for a couple of weeks, and just played records. But then management thought that, you know, if you didn't get callers on a talkback program, you probably weren't going very well. So I did the third thing. I actually accepted their calls and talked to them and tried to talk them around. And I made an astonishing discovery, which I sum up in Adam's first law of talkback radio, that vehemence of expression does not necessarily equate with depth of conviction. Because the people that rang up to talk to me were used to being rewarded for saying unpleasant things. It was what commercial radio is about. They would get a John Laws watch. If they were singularly unfortunate, they'd get two John Laws watches. Or they'd get free dinners at appalling restaurants. And so they were used to being patted on the head for being repulsive. Now, the other motives for ringing up and saying these extraordinary things is that people, I think, were rehearsing the ideas to see if they liked them, and or they were simply getting on the wireless. It was the price of admission. If you rang up and said something absolutely reasonable about homosexuals, trade unionists, Labour politicians, dole bludgers, whatever, if you rang up, you got on. If you ring up and say something reasonable, it just didn't fit the format, because just as tabloid journalism relies on a certain energetic simplification of complicated issues, talkback radio requires that it be reduced to shouting or singing matches. So here I had these people, but I started to suspect that they weren't all that serious that often about what they were saying, that it was what they thought they had to do. So I'd sort of talk to them, and I used as my model a wonderful scene in one of my very favourite films, The Life of Brian. Now, who's seen The Life of Brian? The life of Brian is not about religion, it's about politics. Essentially, it's about splinter groups in the Palestinian liberation movement against ancient Rome. And the best scene in it, apart from the great crucifixion at the end, the best scene in it is when John Cleese, dressed in black pyjamas, is having a little meeting with other members of his splinter group. And he says, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" And there's a silence, and the little voice says, "Aqueducts." You can walk the streets at night. The wine's not bad. And one by one, the people in this anti-Roman group come up with all the benefactions that Rome has showered upon them. And at the end of it, Cleese says, "Hey, I'll give you a bloody aqueduct, some good wine, you can walk the streets at night and it's safe. And you know, but what have the bastards ever done for us?" So I used that technique with the callers. And I found that you could very easily persuade them through the on multiculturalism by using the old food argument. "Oh, I'll give you the dim sim." You know, and from that you could build. You could actually build on the dim sim. And within minutes you were getting people making... Well, you didn't get them from north to south, but you got the needle to shift a little and they would start to acknowledge the possibility that multiculturalism wasn't the worst thing that had ever happened to Australia. You could do it with on all the other topics as well. I won't give you the other instance, I haven't got time, but it was fascinating to see that this process of modification, moderation, could come on stream. And it was to give me great hope later on when, in fact, the One Nation problem started rampaging across Australia like a combination of the Triffids and the prickly pear. So... because I started to suspect that the same thing applied, that a lot of the bluster of bigotry perhaps wasn't as deep and as malevolent, as malignant as it might have appeared at first notion. So anyway, here I am at a radio station which encourages bigotry, which rewards unreasonableness, which runs the line that every issue, every political issue, is simple and can be reduced to slogans. What I was fascinated about was the way Laws, who was the master of it, and to a lesser extent Jones, used the tools of self-aggrandisement. John Laws has a million jingles that have been prepared for him by his guitar strumming amanuensis, John Williams. Williams or Williamson? Anyway, Williamson writes these songs about John, which go along the lines of, "John, John, you're really swell, John, John, your farts don't smell." And Laws plays these all the time himself. I mean, I find that an extraordinary notion, that someone sits at a console and plays songs about how wonderful they are. But that's what John does. And then people who think John is God, a subject on which John agrees, ring up the producers and ask, because they don't know something. They don't know the atomic weight of lead, or they don't know how you get a pension for your grandmother, or they don't know the capital city of whatever. Whatever it is, the question comes in, and this is what they do. Someone looks the answer up, and they give it to John on the computer screen. So he knows what the atomic weight of lead is, which is something I certainly don't. So when the person comes on the air and says, "Oh, John, John, what's the atomic weight of lead?" He says, "Funny you should ask that." And there it is. And so he gets this feeling of being godlike, omniscient, omnipresent. But the same thing applies to the poor politicians who call in. What will happen is, that, of course, the staff call out. They arrange through the aide-de-camp, the press officer, whoever, that the Premier of Victoria will be available for a chat. And then the procedure goes like this. Law says, "Hello." And the little voice says, "Oh, hello, John, I'm the Premier of New South Wales." "Okay, speak up." So this is the way. You know, I've heard Nick Greiner doing this. Bob Carr found it a bit hard to do, so he didn't do it, so he didn't have to get on the program for 3 years. These are the tricks of the trade. Now, okay, these guys have an agenda. They don't get the agenda, as I said, is mainly finger out the window, although Alan Jones has his own, but basically they get it from the Daily Telegraph. Basically, they cannibalise, plagiarise other media. and then run with that all day. Now, the terrible thing that happens in Sydney, and it happens to a lesser extent here, but it certainly happens in Sydney, is that this amplification of aggro, which they pick up out of the Telegraph, sets the agenda. And it can be anything from Jova, Canberra, to the marching bands fiasco. Do you remember that? Was that reported here when these poor marching bands that were booked for the opening of the Olympics were told to go walk? Now, these guys basically don't have huge audiences. The figures you hear are nonsense. They're the cumulative audience. If you hear that someone's got a million listeners, that's adding up 20,000 listeners, you know, for a whole week. They are not huge audiences. We invest these guys with power, the politicians get spooked by them, and you start a feedback loop going. So, the way it works is that the Telegraph, Piers Ackerman, of course, who had a distinguished career in this town, who I cannot distinguish him from Christopher Pearson. He'll have a go, Alan and Jones will pick it up and off they'll run. Oh, now you do get disagreements. Laws will depart from the agenda if Alan's for it. This is interesting. So if Alan's for something, and Alan was for the lady from Ipswich, Laws will be against her, not because he's really against her, he's not against her or for anything, but he'll take an opposing position, so at least you get a sort of bit of balance out of this mess that way. So I used to listen to this, I used to watch the way they bullied the pollies, and I used to see this feedback loop developing, and it got to the extent that at weekends the major political parties have qualitative research groups. They get a room full of people who are deemed to be sociologically or demographically appropriate, and they talk to them about the political issues. Now, given that people are not these days the most enthusiastic newspaper readers, and they tend to get the agenda through this simple trickle-down system I'm describing, the politicians would then get the signal that the biggest political issue on earth were marching bands, or other moral panics that these turkeys would generate. And suddenly governments were shaking in their boots. And we've seen the, I think, quite shameful situation in Australia where if these ignoramuses in Sydney decide that Australia will not even slightly modify its reprehensible drug laws because John Laws, Alan Jones, Stanza Manick and Piers Ackerman don't think they should, they won't do it. And it just stinks, doesn't it, that this little tiny cabal of tenth raters in fact are that powerful. But it's not just here, of course, it's Rush Limbaugh and the other shock jocks in America. Now, I was so pissed off by my close observations of these characters that after I went to Radio National, a network which does a wonderful job and that nobody listens to, which is fine because it means it's very liberating. You can do what you like on Radio National, basically, because there's no program manager saying you shan't. When I got there, I decided to write a book about them. And I wrote a book called Emperors of Air, Talkback, Emperors of Air, in which I revealed all the methodologies and the procedures and the charlatanism that was going on in Talkback around Australia. Now, it isn't everywhere. You've only got one, I think, example of the genre here. You got rid of poor old Darren, didn't you? You had... you've got one fellow here who's in a bit of trouble, I think. Bob Francis. No, there's another name. That one, yes. In Western Australia, they've got the worst. They've got Howard Sattler, who actually makes Alan Jones, I think, seem like a moderate. Sattler is a maniac who says the most appalling things of anyone in Australian media. Melbourne doesn't have any. I don't know why. Probably almost needed one, I think, or two during the Kennedy era, but they don't have any. So it's basically a two-city phenomenon. Now, the fuss, I also talked about the way they're on the take, because I knew of a few cases where free speech had been replaced by fee speech, and I mentioned it in the book. But the book sold moderately, and nobody seemed to pick up on this issue, until a very brave person leaked a document. Now, the great hero of the current media kerfuffle isn't the presenter of Media Watch, It is whoever it was at the Bankers Association who took that document, that smoking gun, and handed it out. Because at that point, the explosion took place. Now, Laws is now having the worst time of his life. He has been caught in... Well, when I realised the scale of it, because even working at TUE, I hadn't realised how big it was, how many millions of dollars were being poured into these guys to get them to stop saying things and to start saying other things. When I heard about this, I rang the DPP in New South Wales and said, this comes under Section 100A of the Crimes Act, because the Crimes Act is about extortion, and you go to jail for 10 years. And every journalist in the country really knows about this. What the Crimes Act says is if you prevent something being published for money, you're guilty of extortion. It's a criminal act. If you substitute that with something else for money, that's double bunga extortion. It's probably 20 years. So I suggested to the DPP that he get into the act and perhaps, you know, have his own investigation. And I was very pleased when the next day the DPP said, as a result of considerable public pressure, that is a phone call from me, he thought it was appropriate that he too look at the 2UE situation. He dropped off at some point, which I think is most unfortunate, but he had his own motivations because he's had a couple of murder trials stuffed by these guys, completely wrecking the trial by the most injudicious statements during their progress. So the legal system in New South Wales is no lover of talkback radio. So we now know what's been going on. We now know that if you pay these guys enough money, they will stop saying the awful things they've been saying about you and have a sudden miraculous change of heart. And it's the banks, it's gambling, it's one of your sponsors today, it's airlines, it's all sorts of things. Now, everyone who's been caught in this net are now wishing that they'd never done it, but it's too late. We now know that John was trying to renegotiate his various contracts after the initial Media Watch revelations, but it didn't happen. Now, I hope that 2UE loses its licence for some considerable time. I hope it because the fellow that runs 2UE was, would you believe it, the vice chairman of the St James Ethics Centre in Sydney. The St James Ethics Centre is run by a very fine religious gentleman, a friend of mine, who market themselves as the great purveyor on ethical conundra, or the great solvers of ethical dilemmas. And they've had a great influence in this country. And to think that the guy that was the deputy chairman of it was allowing this to go on at 2UE staggers the imagination. Just staggers the imagination. So one hopes that they are, in fact, reprimanded, that they're perhaps put off air for a month. That'd be good. Let them go back on air after a month. At least something would happen. But I go back to me, the greater problem is not what they say for money, it's what they say for nothing. And it is the extraordinary outpourings of bigotry, aggression, hatred of all sorts that is pumped out on the ears by these people. Why do people listen to it? Well, I think they listen to it because it's energy. It is simply raw energy. To listen to subtle arguments, to listen to people admitting to complexity, is a bit difficult. You've got to think about it. But it's also, in a curious way, enervating, because you live in a world where everything is so bloody complicated, you're almost immobilised like Hamlet. I know that's happened to me over the years. You know, when I started my first job in journalism, I was writing a column for a communist newspaper when I was 15. Now, everything was dead simple then. But as I get older, everything is more complicated. And my opinions are less certain. And when I listen to Parliament, both sides of the argument seem to be so rational. So I only listen to my side, then I turn the other buggers off. These blokes come on air and they say terrible things. Now, in the morning, I would have thought that Alan Jones is equivalent to a nuclear-powered alarm clock. Now, one doesn't want to wake up in the morning, really. It's not easy, is it? You cling to the pillow lustfully. You try to have carnal relations with the doona. The last thing you want is the post-coital depression of getting up and going to work. So you turn Jones on, And here he is, the parrot, with his quite strange voice, a bit adenoidal, I think. And, well, it's like an electric cattle prod. And you get up and you get on with the rest of the day. So there is something strangely exhilarating about listening to the demonically possessed as opposed to the reasonable. Now, talkback wasn't always like that. It started at... The first talkback announcer in Australia was, I think, Barry Jones. Can you imagine Barry Jones doing a talkback program? Would the callers get a word in edgeways? I think it was theoretically talkback anyway, and I don't know anyone ever got a phone call through, but it was a time when there were a lot of pluralists doing talkback radio around Australia, and I thought then it was a terrific medium, because what other ways are there for the punters to get a word in edgeways? They can write letters to the editor, but many do and few are chosen. They can do graffiti, which I'm a bit hostile about because they keep doing it on my house in Paddington. And so suddenly he was talkback radio. Well, of course, now the new technologies will probably marginalise all those possibilities because now the whole world is full of infinite, unreconstructed chatter that requires no gatekeeper, that no one edits, no one prevents being expressed. But you get a list of names, just prenoms come up on the screen, Fred, Arthur, Gladys, whoever, and their suburb, and from that you're meant to deduce the demographics and the likelihood of what sort of person is you're about to hear from. And then there is a one word on what they wish to discuss. Now, after a while you knew that that name from that suburb was a sociopath who you didn't want to talk to. And so you didn't. So he would ring up, change his name, change his suburb, change his topic, and then sneak under your guard, and after 10 seconds you realised you'd made a terrible mistake. And that's about the only way that dissidents get onto the Laws, Sermanic or Jones programs. I hope that this part of Australian media is cleaned up very, very fast. I hope that Laws... Well, Laws has already copped a huge fine, hasn't he? He's lost... about $1 million already because everyone's had to run away from the deals. And the same thing will happen to Alan Jones, and one hopes that there will be a sort of a fallout which changes the things across Australia. But I come back to the possibility, or to the glass ceiling in Australia, on material of complexity. It saddens me to think that almost by definition, the better the job the media does, the smaller the audience for it. You know, there is a rough correlation between the quality of a newspaper and the size of its audience. There's certainly a very clear correlation between excellence and minuscule ratings in electronic media. And SBS still, in fact, programs more useful material than the rest of the networks, including the ABC, I'm sad to say, put together. It gets 4. An audience of 4. Radio National gets an audience, well, almost infinitesimal. Although if you bulk it up, I can claim at the end of the week that I've spoken to 700,000 people. But it's not. It's the same group all the way through. But the value that people place on that media is absolutely extraordinary. Now, determined to destroy the ABC once and for all, a view that is held with equally by almost any political party, Paul Keating hated the ABC even more than John Howard. Howard thought he would nail it by having an inquiry into it, and he got to Bob Mansfield to run the Mansfield inquiry, hoping that Mansfield would come out with recommendations that would enable them to fillet the ABC and to actually reduce it to but a shadow of its former self. Now, there were 10,000 submissions to the Mansfield Report. 10,000. Not many, I would have thought, in a population of, what, nudging 20 million. But of the 10,000 submissions, 3,000 of them were rapturous about Radio National. And so when Mansfield got to write the report, he had to say, here is an extraordinary thing. Extraordinary thing. Here's this little tiny Radio National. And it is more popular, according to the submissions to the Mansfield Inquiry, than the might of ABC television. Well, those 3,000 people were my listeners. I asked them to send them in. And they bloody well did, the darlings. And you get the same response, you know, from high-quality media. The intensity of response, I think, is quite enormous. In fact, many years ago, when the ABC was struggling to argue its case in Canberra, I suggested that ratings were not the way to go because they weren't getting them. And I said, you've got to demonstrate that you don't have bums on seats, but you have minds in gear. Now, going back, Adam's first law of television predates the remote control, and it was based on the fascinating observation that if you won the news slot, the commercial news slot, at 6 in the afternoon, you then won the night because people were too bloody lazy to get up to walk over to the 17-inch Aster and change the channel. So Adam's first law of television was the weight of the backside is greater than the force of intellect. Now, to some extent, this blew apart when the remote control came in along. But, fascinatingly, people are still too lazy to use the remote. And so if you win news, you tend to have this flow on for the rest of the night. So the guy that ran ABC Research, and I had nothing to do with the ABC, I was just one of its many viewers, listeners, was a guy called Ray Newell. And I said, Ray, you should come up with another method of measurement. And so I said, come up with the IQ rating. No, not intelligence, involvement quotient. Measure the involvement that people have with media as opposed to the mere usage of it. I submit that most media is just on. It's like electronic wallpaper, just there. But if you actually try to find a way of measuring people's commitment to the program, what will happen? Well, he did. He found qualitative ways of doing it, and suddenly some programs that had reasonable ratings jumped out of the screen and chased you around the room. And at the time, it was This Day Tonight was one, Four Corners was another. But across the board, even on commercial stations, there were programs that really mattered. And there are still media outlets that really, really matter. And they're not all highfalutin. I'm not suggesting for a minute that tabloid journalism doesn't have its place. There are times when I love its energy, its vitality, and when I despair of my comrades in broadsheet. But we are moving in a time when, in fact, the whole thing, I suppose, is becoming irrelevant, because within the next 10 to 15 years, we will see the end of mass media anyway. Mass media, a creature of our century, will really not outlive it. The newspaper has ceased to be a mass medium. Most cities had dozens. They're now down to one if they're lucky. Radio, well, when I grew up, we all listened to one of three or four radio stations. They were a mass medium. Now there are 20, 30 or more in most cities, and radio now goes for ever narrower slices of the demographic market. The great magazines that dominated the world when I and many of you were growing up, the Woman's Weeklies here, or The Life, the Saturday Evening Post in the US, magazines which were absolutely icons that everyone read, have either disappeared or are now but pale ghosts of their former self. And instead of, well, women's magazines, there are now dozens and dozens of them, each of them, would you believe, targeted at a tiny slither of the female market. There are now about 5,000 titles available through a newsagent, although they don't stock them all, and they are increasingly esoteric. So you get dozens of newspapers going to different factions in the four-wheel drive community. So this is the way media is. Add to it the plethora of possibilities of television. Television, couple of channels in Australia. David Hill warns us of 300 by the end of the century. He was wrong. We'll have 100. But if you factor in the viewing options that are now coming on stream through the net, well, it's infinite. Now, what does this mean? What it means is that the people like the John Lawses, the Alan Joneses, the Rupert Murdochs, the Kerry Packers even, are about to lose control. What will happen is that the gatekeeper role of journalists, like so many in this room today, those of us who like to think that we set the agenda and provide the key interpretations for people to bone up on, will be brushed aside as people go directly to what they regard as reliable sources. Now, and in this cacophony of information, which one day the current gatekeepers will lose control of, and I was reading this morning that there's a new software which is being created and hybridised within the web,
which is going to knock Bill Gates out of the game within 10 years. Great news. That as this energy, this technological determinism, this genius for innovation continues, mass media goes, it becomes a thing of the past, and suddenly information is democratised. Unfortunately, there's a dark side of that moon, and I'll shut up in a minute. There's a dark side of that moon, which is that media created the nation state. The modern nation is created by mass literacy, to some extent by the newspaper. This nation was created by the telegraph pole, the wire that linked the communities of Australia in the late 19th century, so that the debate on federation could take place. So you had the media creating the modern nation. Now the media, I think, will balkanise them. Here we are, a country of, 180 different ethnic streams, many, many religions, but there has still been a consensus on what Australia is about because of mass media. Remove it from the formula and it will gradually fade away like a Polaroid in reverse. And how do you get a consensus? How do you get a sense of national agreement? How do you even deal with a national crisis? If instead of having the problem of too many people looking at too few media outlets, you suddenly have a world, where there are too many outlets, each with a tiny, fractured, minuscule audience. Now, how do you run a country like that? How do you have an election? It's a fascinating dilemma. And fortunately, I'll be dead before I have to deal with it. But these poor little buggers will have to cope with it. But at least there'll be a job, because everyone can be a journalist in this new world. Everyone can be a publisher. And on that happy note, with thanks for inviting me to the Dick Wordley Memorial Luncheon, I take my leave of you. Thanks very much.
Not quite leave, because we've got questions first.
Oh, okay.
Questions from the media, and please give your name and organisation before you ask your question. The genial clone of Chris Pearson and Piers Ackerman over there will help you.
Piers, how lovely to see you here today.
It's a pleasure to be here. You're a bad man, Philip Adams, but I love you for all that, and I think that you've been very unkind to Alan Jones. He just went underground on that English toilet to have a pee.
Of course he did.
Sitting down.
Of course he did. Ooh. Well, that writ's not for me, thank you. Make your own legal arrangements.
Here is Matthew Abraham, the man straight from the Vatican.
Matthew Abraham from the Southern Cross. A niche publisher.
And a beneficiary of the end of mass media.
Philip, I know you're the thinking woman's crumpet, so I'm not going to take you on here. But you have given us a very Sydney-centric view of the world. Which is fair enough, because that's where you live.
No, I don't. I live on a cattle property, well, 300 k's north.
Well, you're up that. You're up on the east coast. One of the things that I suppose disturbs me about what is happening with the Republican debate at the moment is that the Republic, the yes case, is likely to be lost as a result of a campaign run from a Sydney-centric view, which regards anyone outside of Sydney and Melbourne as moronic talkback fodder and not able to accept arguments, or dismisses a simplistic response as not a valid response. And I'm wondering why, for instance, the Republic, the yes case, did not embrace the direct election model.
Did not embrace the
directly elected president model. Because
okay.
That's, from the polls we have today, from News Poll Today, it's what people want, and it would have given us a republic.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're right. Australia is Sydney-centric, and I take no pleasure in that. I came from Melbourne. Melbourneians hate Sydney even more than people in Adelaide do. And it appalled me to see one by one every major communications organisation taking root in Sydney. It wasn't simply the Fairfaxes and the Packers. It was, of course, the ABC. It was the film school. It was all the structures that Gorton and Whitlam and everyone else put in place to help the arts, the Australia Council. Everything was rooted in New South Wales. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. As it happens, I go around Australia talking to local communities about the importance of local media, incidentally, because a good local newspaper, I think, is indispensable to help you cope with globalism. If you don't have good local media, you've got no hope. And one wishes that Australia had a better tradition of defiant local papers who do a damn good job reporting on the third tier of government or on regional issues. I think Paul Keating's biggest mistake wasn't his friendship with Suharto. I think it was picking Malcolm Turnbull to run the Republican cause. I mean, many of us find Malcolm so terrifying. I mean, Kerry Packer once said to me, when we had a brief friendship, Kerry said, never get between Malcolm Turnbull and a quid. He said, you'll be killed. Well, you don't get between Malcolm Turnbull and anything. And Malcolm, in a sense, has not been someone who's brought people into this campaign. It's not his nature. He's never stood for elective office, so he's never had to be voted for. And basically, he's an imperialist. You know, and I think that hasn't been good. But you're right, this state has a very proud history in the whole argument about federation. South Australia was a standard setter in many of the great sort of issues that helped make Australia a nation. And it has been run out of Sydney. Bad mistake. I don't know the dynamics of it here. I'm astonished that Kim Bonython is such an ardent monarchist, because Kim likes jazz. And jazz has no connection with the royal family, except as we worked out at this table with perhaps Duke Ellington. But I'm still not sure that on the day it mightn't be surprising. If there's one thing that's happened lately, it's we know that the polls have been majestically unreliable. Look at Victoria. Not only the polls, the punditry. Getting it completely wrong. So, I don't know. Direct election, I oppose it. I oppose it because I know it will produce the most politicised presidency. I reckon that the bloke that's got the job at the moment, Bill Dean, is just wonderful. I mean, Dean's a phenomenal human being. I never heard of him. I don't know the names of High Court judges, apart from Michael, what's his name? Anyway, Bill Dean is fabulous. John Howard hates him. There's a great credential. And he has done a great job right through this whole period of Mabo Week and all the rest of it. Bill Dean would never be elected president. He wouldn't stand for the election. You know, nor would any of his distinguished predecessors, with the possible exception of Bill Hayden. You know, if you go for direct election, you might get Alan Jones for president. You might get John Laws. You might get, more seriously, you might get Dick Smith. Now, Dick's all right, but God help us. You know, I think the idea of who on earth is a majority of both houses of parliament going to pick? Not a politician. There might be two people in the federal politics who are sufficiently popular across both sides of the house to get up. One of them was silly old Tim Fisher, and the other one might be Barry Jones. See, and Barry's not even a politician, as Bob Hawke constantly reminded him. So the one way, I think, to get really interesting people up in this New Deal is to have them appointed or anointed. If you go for election, it will be the only person in the country who was federally elected, and it will become an expensive, nasty fight, and you will finish up with a president that half the people didn't want. By definition, that half the people didn't want. How does that hold the country together? But I think you're right. I think on the cards, people being told that it ain't broke, don't fix it, the essential conservatism of Australia will count against it. But 30 years ago, we had an election which was a miracle. And that was the election which decided to admit that Aborigines were human beings. Overnight, you know, something happened in this country after 70 years, no, 60 years, of the White Australia policy, of the most vicious piece of bigotry in legislative form on earth, and I include in that apartheid, which didn't last anything like as long, suddenly, what, 97% of Australians voted in favour of Aborigines. I don't think they would now. I spoke to a couple of Aboriginal leaders about it, and they think that... What one of them said to me, no, it's not that Australia is more bigoted, it's that bigotry is better organised.
Des Ryan?
Des Ryan is Editor-in-Chief of Messenger Press, Mr. President.
Possibly the last of the mass media. I was intrigued by your prediction that the end of mass media is nigh. From my position, I don't see that. I see that the diversity which has grown up over the last 10 years, whether it be magazines and the coming of digital television, the web, are in fact precisely where News Limited and the Packers and the Microsofts of this world are. I don't I'd be interested in knowing what the time frame is, because I don't see it imminent.
Well, look, first of all, even cinema is losing its clout as a mass medium. People see the Titanic, they see it all over the world, but they don't necessarily see it in a huge cinema. They see it on a video replay. In other words, even that market is being fragmented and fractured. But the other media that I went through, it is well developed. A mass media is a medium that a mass of people look at. Yes, there is still a mass consuming media, but they're consuming, as you say, more and more media. The miracle is that thus far, the old players have managed to stay on the, to get the toll booths, if you like, on the information superhighway. Now, I gave evidence to Diamond Jim McClellan's tariff board, no, not tariff, Senate inquiry into media ownership 25 years ago, and talked about the new media, because even then, we didn't know what it was, but it was fairly clear that something was going to come along. And add to that the fact that the monoliths are crumbling. All the great monoliths are crumbling. You've got, the Kremlin is one monolith which fell apart. You've got the Forbidden City won't be far behind it. The Vatican's in trouble. You know, what, 32% of Americans vote for the president? You know, it's an amazing situation where these massive structures are disintegration. And it even happens to nations. Now, in that world where people are, in fact, becoming members of ever smaller cultural groups, along comes the new technologies, which gives each and every one of them their own media. This is why I talk about the balkanizing effect. So you've got, for instance, children all over Australia, probably plugged into, not many, but some of them plugged into the Trenchcoat Mafia website. We know that the Ku Klux Klan have now got, what do they call them, Covens, whatever it is, in Darwin and in Sydney and probably elsewhere, so that every little minority group can now have its own little feedback loop, can now reach out. You've got the Adelaide Institute here, you know, Frederick Tobin, who is connected to every ultra-right-wing anti-Semitic organisation on earth. So I remember making a point somewhere recently that even if Australia had never had one overseas migrant, we'd still be a multicultural society because we belong to different subcultures. Subcultures of religious attitude, of sexual proclivity, of lifestyle choice. That's what I mean about the death of mass media and it being replaced by the other. Now, you're right. At the moment, Bill Gates is the gatekeeper. But I was reading this morning about this new software, which is freely available, which is non-copyright. Everyone can use it. And it's being picked up by more and more and more of the people on the web who want to stick it up Bill Gates. And it's anticipating the death of Gates. And I would be astonished if it didn't happen. And as the sort of energy bursts out of all the new technologies, I really don't believe that in 10 or 20 years the current players will be technologically able to keep the controls. I just don't see it. I think that the spontaneous combustion in communications is even cleverer than Kerry. And I live in that hope. I mean, you know, look, I've already admitted that there are some aspects of mass media which are congenial and helpful. You know, there's always a dark side. but wouldn't it be great if in the next generation of journalists could have 50, 60, 100 potential employers instead of half a dozen? Well, there you go. I've got one supporter in the room. Okay.
Any more questions?
Yeah, Peter Mike from Sunday Mail.
You speak to us of the realms of these people, of the ideological and the popular consensus. You talk to us about the gatekeepers of the Fourth Estate and obviously their subsequent investigation of the media by media. But out in the coalface, we're starting to find more and more that we're encountering the sifters and the people who drive the agenda of the day. Our public relations officers, our media liaison representatives. Where do you see them fitting into the scene of the media, and how healthy do you think it is that they're driving the agenda and it's not so much on the popular front page?
Well, I'm glad you've raised the issue because, of course, they are being looked at through the 2UE inquiry. But in the best of all possible worlds, that would radiate out and look at all the deals that are done and the influence peddling. And all of us know that too much of Australian print media is simply PR releases with a perhaps a modified or restructured headline. It stinks. I can remember once giving a talk to the Public Relations Institute in Canberra, saying, public relations? What bullshit, what a misnomer. Nothing public about what you bastards do. It's the private relations industry, isn't it? And it's subtle, and it's skilled, and it's getting better all the time. But it's not. If all we do is allow the 2UE inquiry to let some pressure off, you know, to vent some spleen, and don't consider the implications beyond that, not only simply across commercial radio, but across all media, we're making a serious mistake. There's no question of that, and I'm very glad you raised the issue.
One more question, I think.
Mr. President, a very important person in our club, as you know, Mignon Arendt-Ellicott.
Thank you. Mignon Arendt, formerly ABC. Philip Adams, in reference to your comments about the ABC and its ratings, I'd just like to say that the ABC was never concerned with ratings. The original idea of the ABC was to provide programs for 10% of the population, which included the intelligentsia, people like you.
The RISI and ABC. Well, if that's how it started, that's not where it's at. The ABC is obsessed with ratings as any other organisation. It allows the continued existence by, and it's a miracle it's still there, of Radio National, because Radio National happens to be on charter. But much of the ABC's activities is wholly and purely commercial. I take no pleasure in ABC television programming. I think most of it now is pretty bloody ordinary. Too much of it is British, of course, because they can no longer afford to do much local production. The idea of the ABC, incidentally, is massively biased is such a nonsense. We're biased in Radio National. We're all unreconstructed Stalinists. But the rest of the ABC is so conservative. And the test of this is when the ABC's budget was cut, it caused hell to the Liberal Party through the branch structures. Because the typical viewer of the ABC, the typical listener of the ABC, is middle class and conservative. And I'm very proud of the fact that I am with the lunatic left wing of the ABC. It's about that big, but it's still there.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for having me.